Good morning, everyone. We are very happy to convene the Nevada Court of Appeals here at Canyon Springs High School. I'm Michael Gibbons. I'm joined today by Judge Jerome Tao. Judge Abby Silver, unfortunately, had an emergency and could not be here this morning. However, these proceedings are being recorded, and she will be listening to the recording, and she's been very involved in this case, and so she will be participating in the decision. Canyon Springs is a high school here in North Las Vegas that has a law academy program, and that's what attracted the court to want to have an actual court proceeding in your school. It's not very often that high school students can actually be involved in the study of the law, and what better way to learn it other than to participate in a real court proceeding? So this is an appellate court. And unlike a trial court, we don't hear from witnesses. We already have a record about what happened in the district court, and then there was an appeal, so we look at the record already made. And at the end of all of our cases today, we are willing to stay and answer questions, and if any of the lawyers can stay, please do also. We have two very interesting cases here today. And before we get into those, I just wanted to see, Judge Tao, do you have any welcoming comments here for the students?
First of all, can everybody hear me if I don't use the mic? We've got to use this. Is this better if I hold this down? Okay. I just wanted to thank everybody for accommodating us. We always enjoy coming to places outside the courthouse. Usually when we hear appellate arguments in the courthouse, very few people show up because people like watching actual trials. You guys have seen trials on TV. They're kind of fun. You have witnesses, evidence, all that kind of stuff. At the appellate level, it tends to be more intellectual, so not a lot of people come and watch our arguments. So we always enjoy going to different high schools or colleges or law schools because it's an opportunity for you guys to see an argument that might otherwise be really hard for you to see, to trek all the way down to the courthouse and watch something like this. So we really appreciate your accommodating us, and I want to thank the administration for accommodating your schedule so that you guys can miss a couple classes and come and watch us. And we're hoping that this will be interesting and educational for everybody.
Okay. Thank you. We also have our court staff here today, too, in the entire back row to my left. So we have our civil staff attorneys. We have a law clerk and a judicial assistant and a judicial intern who's graduating from law school this Friday, and we also have some court staff on the other side of the courtroom too. Two law clerks and judicial chambers administrator, and then also here in the front. I didn't name everybody because we'd be here a pretty long group for all the introductions, but we're fully committed to this, and you can see with our entire staff here today how important we consider the cases to be and also this particular event. To my right is Tom Harris, who's the court clerk for our court. You heard him with our introduction, and we also have a court recorder, so all of these proceedings, again, are being recorded. And then I see the school is also filming the proceedings, so we're going to have a really complete record. Okay. Each side is allowed 15 minutes to argue its case, and the appellant can also reserve time for a rebuttal argument out of that 15 minutes if it chooses to do so. We have a civil case today and a criminal case. I hope the students have already looked at the summaries of these cases and also some of the briefs if you had a chance. The first case is number 67453, and that's the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, the District Council, Local 15. It's a long name, so we're just going to refer to it as the union on one side as the appellant. And on the other side, we have Great Wash Park, LLC, which is the limited liability company. But it's doing business as Tivoli Village, so we'll just refer to that as Tivoli or Tivoli Village on the other side of the case for ease of reference for everyone here today. Okay. So for the appellant, we have David Rosenfeld. Mr. Rosenfeld wasn't the attorney that argued the case in the lower court, but it's often different on the appellate part because it's the way a case is presented is different. So, Mr. Rosenfeld, we're really happy to have you here today, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. David Rosenfeld for the union. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This is a case about trespass by photons. After thinking about this more carefully, I have to concede that the photon, which is light, is a particle. It's one of the elementary particles, of which there are 30 or 40 or 50 that nuclear physicists talk about. It has a unique aspect to it as a particle. It has no mass, no electric charge, moves at the speed of light, is not affected by gravity. It's considerably different. And when it moves, it's really not a particle, it is a wave. It acts like a wave. So what Ray Walsh is accusing us of doing is trespassing by photons, by light. When I'm looking at the core here, I see two black rows. Those are photons that I can register. It's also like email, because email is sent not over copper wires anymore, but over fiber optics. And those fiber optics send photons. So when you get a spam email, that's nothing more than photons entering into a computer, which then converts it into a screen, which then emits photons. So that's sort of a form of trespass by photons. And I say that because Great Wash is asserting what is a very remarkable proposition, that light constitutes trespass. The second important part about this case that I think is lost is that the damage, the concern that Great Wash raises is not the effect on the facade, not the effect upon its property, not the effect on the paint on the side of the building. And the lower court ruled that there was no damage. What they're concerned about is the economic consequences. They made that clear in a complaint. They made that clear in every memorandum they filed. They made that clear in the oral argument before the court below, that what they were concerned about was the effect on their revenue, their business reputation. It's a business problem. It's a business tort. And the court below, in issuing the injunction, held that it was doing so because of the economic effect of the message on Great Wash's tenants, and therefore the effect on Great Wash as a business. And this becomes important when we address whether it really is trespass, but also, from a union lawyer's point of view, becomes very important when we talk about whether this is preempted by federal law. Because the concern here wasn't the photons on the side of the building. The concern was this message that had an effect, or at least they claimed had an effect, on their business.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's get away from the science of it. When lawyers argue science, it's always a dangerous thing. I don't know if you've taken a class in quantum mechanics, but I have a degree in electrical engineering. I've taken a whole bunch of classes, and the science of it tends to be very complicated. So let's make it more legal, all right? Let's flip it onto the right. Why do you get to use the side of someone else's building as a billboard for your message, whether it's photons or paint or anything else?
Because the question is, if it's photons, if it's light, is it trespass?
Well, let's imagine this then. This is the problem with the science. I'm going to give you a hypothetical right now. Let's say instead of using this light projector, you used a high-powered laser and you burned a message into the wall. You never actually crossed the property line, but you caused physical damage to the building. You burned your message in there. Okay. Are you saying that you can do that just because you didn't cross their property line in a physical way?
No, absolutely not. And that's what the modern trend in trespass says, that when you're talking about intangible objects, whether it's light, sound, vibration, intangible, quote, things like light or sound or vibrations or smells becomes trespass when there's some physical damage, some damage to the property. The California Supreme Court addressed this Hamidi case, which we've kind of cited, but it's kind of a lead case. That was a case of spam. And the question was whether that was trespass. And 10 years ago, the Supreme Court said that it is not trespass because it doesn't affect the property. There's no damage to the property. And so I would agree that if there were damage any kind, that would be a form of physical trespass. It's just like if we were out there pounding away with drums causing vibration, the damage to the building, that would be trespass.
So the model, part of the lack of damages here is because, I gather, is because this only happened on three nights for a few minutes at a time. Are you saying, let's take it out even further, are you saying that you have the right to project this message onto their light, under their wall, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and there'd be no damages just because it's light and as opposed to the harm of the message?
Well, there are two forms of damages. I would agree, yes, we would, except, and again, this is what every case in every other jurisdiction has said that's addressed intangible things. Every other case has said that it's only trespass when it has some damage to the building, to the structure, to the object, to some other property of that nature, whether it's chattel or real property. Where they don't go is to say that if there's no damage, I agree there's some economic potential. There's no record proving it. Keep in mind that this image was not viewable from Great Wash. It was only viewable, and we have no record that anyone actually saw it, it was only viewable from the public street, people driving or walking. So there's no evidence in this record that there was one single person who chose not to go there because of the sign. But that, Your Honor, is exactly the problem here, is that what the court found, what Great Wash argues, is that the purpose of this signage, of this message, was to interfere with their business, to cause them economic damage. And that's why it's preempted under federal law, because although I would agree if we trespassed in the sense of a physical intrusion, and all the cases they've cited about trespass are logs, people, cattle, not intangible objects.
Do you think, counsel, that the district court made the correct distinction to call this a tangible intrusion by having a message projected as opposed to just light projected?
Well, that is incorrect. It's not tangible in any respect. It is a message. It is light on the building. And this court would be, again, way out from where every other court has gone when dealing with all these intangible things or objects or particles. And they've drawn this clear line saying that you have to show some kind of damage to the property before they will find a trespass. Now, let me say, now, that what we could do could be a nuisance in some cases. That's really what the tort we're talking about, because nuisance doesn't require damage. It requires an interference in the business, in the use of the property. So we agree that if we were to take this light and shine it in windows, now I was up late last night preparing for this case and I got in, and I had to close the window because right across from Dally's was this very bright neon light that shone into my window. I was thinking, this is trespass. It's almost a nuisance, but I closed the window and dealt with it, the blind. So I think the law suggests that this really, if anything, is a nuisance, because it can interfere with the business. But that, of course, is another preemption issue.
But the complaint didn't specify which tort was involved here, and the order from the district court just said tortious conduct. Nuisance was mentioned, but it's just mentioned in passing. It seems like the focus was on trespass. If nuisance is a claim that might be argued in this case, should the case stay alive, even if trespass was not proven?
No, because they abandoned the nuisance argument. They never made that argument. They haven't made it here. They haven't said that this is a nuisance case, because they also know that that leads them down the path of both federal preemption, because it only then ends up being a business tort of interfering with their business, and it's also not a substantial interference with their business. Keep in mind, this sign did not affect one person at Great Wash. Nobody at Great Wash, as far as the record shows, could see it. So it's not like cases like the retail property case that we've talked a lot about in terms of federal preemption. In retail property, you have a group of union activists walking into the shopping mall, banging pots, accosting people, picketing, interfering with ingress, violating time, place, and manner rules. And I concede that is a form of trespass. That's certainly a form of nuisance, because it directly interferes with business. But the sign on the side of the building, which is only viewable by the public, cannot in any sense be nuisance.
Is this issue still alive, or is this moot? This happened in June of 2014, so 23 months ago. Where are we now?
We'll be back when the court issues its decision. And I say that, Gary, not to be smug about this, but I'm here because this is a very important issue to this union and other unions. The right to bring a message through non-trespassory, non-nuisance messaging. It's a real legitimate First Amendment prior restraint problem. We want the right to do this, and I think the record's clear we were pretty careful here. Very careful. We stayed on public property at all times. That is, the person holding the light, didn't block, no evidence blocked people, interfered with egress or ingress, and shown the light image, which was truthful. The court below found it was truthful. On a facade, no windows, nobody at Wash could see it, so we were very circumspect and careful in what we did, and we want the right to continue to bring messages to the public that pursue our object of bringing to the public our problem with Great Wash, which was using a non-union contractor to build part of its project. So we will be back there, and we are not there because of the court's injunction, which we understand and respect. But we will be back there, assuming we prevail in this case. So it is not moot. And I think as the record reflects, we were very careful because we agreed not to continue the conduct while the court was considering the injunction proceedings. And then when the court issued the injunction, of course, we haven't violated it.
I'm sure a lot of people have driven by Tivoli Village, and so it looks like a completed building. So even if there's no construction going on, this protest could theoretically continue?
Yes, it could, because we put the message back there because we want others to know in Las Vegas that if you don't do the right thing and use union contractors, you may see this message for a long time. And I was asked a question that, from a labor lawyer's point of view, is a great question. Because the cases have said we can be out there messaging as long as we want, even though that construction project is dead. In fact, there are a whole series of cases called bannering cases where the labor board, like in the labor's Local 872 case that I cited, put messages out there long after the contractor's gone just to remind that casino or that hotel or that restaurant, you know, the next time you do something, you really want to do it right, not wrong.
Well, it's the purpose of a secondary boycott. You want to drive out the tenant so that the person who built the property doesn't make a profit off of what he built of it in the future. They don't build one with non-union labor. That's the purpose of a secondary boycott, right?
I can't say how exactly I agree with Your Honor's comment. If this was a secondary boycott, that was the purpose of the boycott, and the purpose was to interfere with Great Wash's business, the business of the tenant, to bring home our message.
By the way, is this the same protest that had the giant inflatable rat on the corner there at Rampart and Alta? Or was that a different
that, that was another one of my clients who had that. All right.
That was mentioned in the district court. Oh, you're down to 2.5 minutes now, Mr. Rosenfeld. Do you want to still say that?
I will. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Debbie Leonard on behalf of Great Wash Park, doing business as Tivoli. Your Honors, I'd like you to imagine these scenarios. In anticipation of Selena Gomez's upcoming show at Mandalay Bay projects a 100-foot-high image of Selena Gomez on the wall of Planet Hollywood, which is the location of the competing Britney Spears show. Or imagine this scenario. Having run out of space on its own signs, a bar projects its happy hour specials on the exterior wall of a neighboring preschool. Or imagine this scenario. A disgruntled former restaurant employee projects the words, "You don't want to eat here," over a billboard for the restaurant from which he just got fired. Or imagine this scenario. An artist who could not get a gallery or museum to show his works projects provocative drawings on the tower at the Smith Center here in Las Vegas. Or imagine this scenario. I don't like the color of my neighbor's pink house. I want it to look white, so I project a white light onto the exterior of my neighbor's house.
Well, let me ask you this. Fundamentally, let's talk about the tort here. Fundamentally, the difference between a trespass and a nuisance is trespass can be absolute. If I want to be a hermit and put a fence around my property and put no trespassing signs and sue everybody who sets foot on my property, I can do that. Everybody would hate me, but I have the legal right to do that. I might not have suffered any damages, but a tort has been committed. But nuisance, on the other hand, has an element of reasonableness. You balance the harm against the price of living in an urban society, right? In nuisance cases, you know, sometimes you have to put up with light, noise, vibration, sound, you know, smoke, those kinds of things, as the price of living in a society where stuff is going on. People are driving, there's construction going on, and you benefit from that. If this is a trespass, then the violation is absolute once the light enters the property. You're talking about extreme cases where there's like a 100-foot thing. What about my neighbor's Christmas lights? If there's a right for me to exclude light from my property in a trespassery sense, can I sue my neighbor for putting up Christmas lights?
Well, Your Honor, I think the key thing here is something that every law student has learned, every first-year law student learns in their property class, that property rights are like a bundle of sticks, and each stick represents a different facet of property rights. One of the most important rights is the right to exclusive possession, and that's the absolute of trespass that you, Your Honor, just described. But the importance is that the property owner gets to control the external appearance of its own property. It has dominion over the external appearance of its own property, total control. The Christmas light example that you gave is something that comes from the neighboring property. It is a result, a secondary, I don't want to use the term secondary, it's a side effect of the neighboring property's owner's own exercise of their own property rights.
Well, let's say the picketers are standing on the sidewalk holding a huge sign, a 20-foot-long sign that has the same message on it. If you can see that from your property, that is literally light reflecting off the sign in the shape of those words onto your property. It's just not as powerful as the beam here. So why would that not be a trespass?
Well, in that example, the union's message, their feet and their message are on the public sidewalk. In our example, their feet may be on the public sidewalk, but their message is on our private property, our wall, and but for our private wall, they could not convey their message because it's being our wall is being used as a billboard. And so that, I think, is the distinction. We have exclusive control over our wall. We get to decide whether it has signs or it doesn't have signs, whether it has lighting or it doesn't have lighting, what color it is, what texture it is, what aesthetic the property owner wants to convey to the world. That is part of the bundle of sticks, the right to exclusive possession, and that's what they're interfering with.
But every time a car comes by and its headlights sweep on your property, every time a police helicopter comes by with a searchlight and sweeps on your property, it changes the appearance of your property, at least for a minute. Why are those things not trespasses?
Well, I think, Your Honor, there are certain things that are within the control of local land use ordinances. For example, the Clark County has certain requirements with regard to lighting, with regard to signage. Every property owner knows that their property rights are subject to those types of local ordinances. And those local ordinances are necessary in order for a society to maintain order. And so the type of lighting that you're talking about is not the same because every property owner knows that their bundle of rights is subject to local law.
Well, what makes it different? Let's say police helicopter, they're out there searching for some fugitive, right? What makes it different? Is it the brightness or is it the fact that it's not in the shape of words?
I would submit it does not matter whether there's a word projected or an image projected or just light. It's the intentional causing of a thing to be conveyed onto another property. Now, the police helicopter example you used, again, these are something that are a side effect of another legitimate use. This is not the union doesn't have any property ownership rights and doesn't claim to. Their right is to do whatever they want to do on public property. They can march up and down. They can have the same message on a sign. It doesn't matter what the sign said or what the message said in this case. It was its existence on the facade of Tivoli Village.
All right. Ms. Leonard, I want to follow up on something that was stated by Mr. Rosenfeld. He said when you get into certain torts that this might lead to preemption, meaning it would have to be heard through the Federal Labor Relations Board. The complaint that was filed in this case didn't mention a particular tort. Didn't say trespass, didn't say nuisance, didn't say intentional interference with business relations or economic relations. It didn't say. It simply argued for an injunction, and then the judge ruled that there was tortious conduct, but didn't identify what the tort was. Was this done intentionally to put this in the realm of trespass so you could avoid the federal application of federal law here? And as you know, courts are have to rule on only what's right in front of them. Is this more of a legislative question? Because all of the examples you gave sound like terrible interferences with use of somebody's property. But is that really trespass? Is it something else?
I heard Your Honor asking a couple of questions. With regard to the pleading, I think the case was argued below as a trespass case, and I don't know what the intention behind the complaint was. I wasn't counsel below, so I can't address that specifically. But I would submit, Your Honor, this is not a matter up to the legislature. This is a common law property right. Again, it's part of the bundle of sticks. And it was argued below, and they are arguing here that anybody can do this. It doesn't matter whether it's a union or it's not a union. It's a physical tort, a property tort invading space. It is not an economic tort that we're talking about. And they're not saying that a state court can selectively apply trespass law to the benefit of a union. That's not the argument they're saying, because that would be unconstitutional. They're arguing that the state court is preempted from entering an injunction. But I would like to point out a couple of things in the record. One is that the union stipulated to a temporary injunction. They agreed to allow the district court to enter injunctive relief, yet they're standing up here and arguing that the ability, the power of a state court to enter an injunction was preempted. That seems inconsistent with their conduct below. They also didn't make any effort to put in the record any type of union conduct or labor dispute. Just because they happen to be a union, and the rat example that you gave, that was actually the union's counsel in the matter below noted that was actually a totally separate labor dispute. In this case, we don't have any evidence in the record of a labor dispute just because the union was involved. So again, this is a physical tort. And going back to the invasion...
Actually, let me ask you about the preemption question while we're on that topic.
Okay.
We have this retail services case from the Ninth Circuit from only a couple years ago, a relatively recent case. It says an exception preemption is if the conduct violates a local tort that is deeply rooted in local feeling. You know the language I'm talking about. That can be read in two different ways, right? In this case, the district judge issued an injunction based on the tort of trespass, but no Nevada case has ever held that light constitutes a trespass. So when you're talking about deeply rooted in local feeling, are you talking about the fact that it is a tort, or are you talking about the expansion of a recognized tort to encompass a new circumstance? What is the deeply rooted local feeling referring to? The name of the tort or the way the tort has been applied? In other words, if we're talking about a new application of Nevada trespass law to light, a situation that's never encompassed before, is that something that's deeply rooted in local feeling, or does that matter for the legal test?
Well, I think that I have two responses to that, and I think it's more than just the nature of the tort. I think that the common law right to exclusive possession is deeply rooted in local feeling. But I also think that if you imagine the mischief that would ensue if the union's argument were accepted, that no property owner would have control over the lighting and the signage on its property, that we would have people up and down the strip doing projection bombing, and the property owners would say to Clark County, sorry, we're not able to comply with the local ordinances regarding light and signage because we don't have control over what people are doing from the sidewalks. That can't be right, because that absolutely interferes with something so uniquely local in nature, which is zoning, land use, the right to control the aesthetic of a community. That is absolutely local. And if Clark County can't control it because there's nobody to enforce lighting and signage requirements against, then that is absolutely something that comes into what's described in Retail Property Trust and the Sears case from the U.S. Supreme Court, on which it relies, that this is something that's uniquely local in nature. At most, labor is a peripheral concern, which is other language that's used.
Well, here's really where my question is, and I'm not, maybe you're getting it and not sure how to answer, but this is a tort. Trespass has been around since the times of Blackstone back in England, right? You've always been able to physically invade someone else's property by putting, you know, by riding your horse onto a property or by setting foot on it or throwing something on it, right? But 100 years ago, you couldn't really do much in terms of light except maybe light a huge bonfire and, you know, some of the light would drift over into the property. There wasn't such a thing as a light bulb or a searchlight. Now you have all this technology. You got lasers, you got infrared beams, you got all this stuff that didn't exist, okay? So what's deeply rooted in local feeling about this new technology?
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that the exclusive possession is what is deeply rooted. And now we have new technology that did not exist when any of the cases on which the union relies. And I would note, actually, the cases they rely on that describe light and sound and vibrations or noise, in most of those cases, the discussion of light is dicta. The case before it had nothing to do with light. The two cases that they note, published decisions, are from the 1940s, talking about drive-in movie theaters and having light disrupting the ability of the viewers to see, which, again, that's all can be addressed through local ordinance, and it is something that is a side effect of the exercise of property rights of the neighboring property owner.
Why can't it be ordinance here, though, Clark County Commission or the state legislature, to say that you can't project images onto somebody's building? We're not going to get into content, so it won't be a First Amendment question, but you just can't interfere with somebody's use of their property.
Well, Your Honor, Clark County Code already says that. What they were doing violated the Clark County Code, that it limits the type of light, that there can't be temporary light in nature, it can't be projected upwards. But this is something that a property owner is able to control through its own right to exclusive possession, that we don't want to have to wait for the government to step in and say, hey, you guys need to cut that out. It already says that, and they're violating the local code, but a property owner has the right to go to court and say, they need to stop it. I don't need to wait for the Clark County to step in and take care of that situation.
Ms. Leonard, I have one other procedural question I need to ask you before the time's up. This happened in June of 2014. The court case was filed in August of 2014. It didn't go to court for a couple months. There was an agreement in the meantime to the union would not engage in this conduct of shining the light. When it went to court, Judge Sturman ruled in an order after court that this violated the law. It was trespassing. It should be stopped. You cannot project onto the building. Then she asked the attorney to prepare the order that had the specifics in it. That order was prepared. In neither Judge Sturman's order nor in the order prepared by the attorney and signed by her does it state that the plaintiff shall file a bond. In the order that was originally submitted with the motion, it had a blank spot in it for filling in the bond amount. Isn't a bond mandatory for a preliminary injunction? And if it's not in there, it's fatally defective?
Your Honor, that's the first time anybody has raised that issue, so I am not aware of, and as I said, I wasn't counsel below, so I am not sure how that played out, but I think that the union's agreement to the injunction, the temporary injunction, I think that they've waived any argument with regard to the need for a bond if they haven't raised it before. So if I could just conclude by saying the district court correctly exercised its discretion to enter an injunction here. If there's no law to protect against this, then how does a property owner control the outward appearance of its property? How does a local county control the aesthetic that it has sought to obtain with its ordinances? So with that, we would respectfully request that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right, Mr. Rosenfeld, you have 2.5 minutes.
On the bond issue, it was not raised, and we waived the bond. There are too many important issues that I think both of us would like resolved if we can. And I go back to your point about deeply rooted. I'm a union lawyer. I've dealt with preemption since I began practice. This is the perfect preemption case in light of your question. Because retail property talks about trespass, but not trespass alone. It says this was accompanied by raucous behavior. The folks who are on the property in California and property rights are
well, I mean, her response to that question was it's not about how the tort was committed. It's about the fact that the tort of trespass is something that protects a deeply rooted feeling. Whether you violate that by, you know, with a horse carriage 100 years ago or an automobile now or, you know, a drone in the future, doesn't matter. It's not the facts of the tort. It's the fact that the tort is rooted in deep local feeling. That I gather, is her argument.
So why
do the facts of the trespass
matter? That falls into the trap that, again, Retail Services says the reason it is not preempted is that the physical being of these protesters on the mall itself was not the subject of the injunction. That, it implies, was preempted. And under the Seventh Circuit case in Smart, it would have been preempted. What wasn't preempted was the conduct, the behavior of banging on pots, banging on railings, holding picket signs, blocking people. That's what wasn't preempted, because that is deeply rooted. And the court goes on to say the cases where preemption has been found in this secondary conduct are cases of interference with business, interfering with property. What isn't preempted, and they cite all these cases, is violence or conduct like that. Now, there wasn't, quote, violence in Retail Services. There was some other misconduct on the property, and that's why it wasn't preempted. And that's a very important line, because if you go back to Sears, all that occurred was Sears sought an injunction against the location of the picketing, the persons on their property. They were very careful not to seek an injunction because it interfered with the business or the purpose of the picketing or the effect of the picketing. And when Judge Sturman signed her order in this case, drafted by counsel, it was very clear, because she says several times, the problem here is the effect on the business, the effect on the profits. And that's why it was preempted. I would just want to give the cite to the Clark County Ordinance so you have it, because nobody cited it, nobody relied on it, and it doesn't apply. It's 30.56.135, entitled Outdoor Lighting Standards.
30.56.135?
It's Part F, Lighting Standards, 30.56.135, Outdoor Lighting Standards for Commercial, Industrial, and Special Developments. It doesn't apply here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roosevelt. Ms. Leonard, if you wanted to submit anything else regarding the Clark County ordinances, you could.
Yeah, you can get a chance to respond to that. So if you want to submit something.
I'm in writing. Okay. Not that you have to, if you want to. Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel. Both of you did an excellent job. I think you made the issues very clear. There are a lot of issues in this case, and I hope the students were able to follow along with that, too. This matter will stand submitted to the court for a decision at a later time. As I mentioned earlier, Judge Abby Silver is participating in the case. She will be reviewing the recording of the proceeding, and so she'll be fully informed as to what happened.